and a bad week.
I just don't think Iron Man is much of a superhero.
You're breaking my heart, Aza. So you see Saturn up there?
Using his Iron Man as a pointer, he told me how you can tell the difference between a planet and a star, and where different constellations were. And he told me that our galaxy was a big spiral, and that a lot of galaxies were.
Every star we can see right now is in that spiral. It's huge.
Does it have a center?
Yeah,
he said.
Yeah, the whole galaxy is rotating around this supermassive black hole. But very slowly. I mean, it takes our solar system like 225 million Earth years to orbit the galaxy.
I asked him if the spirals of the galaxy were infinite, and he said no. And then he asked about my spirals. I told him about this mathematician, Kurt Gödel, who had this really bad fear of being poisoned, so much so that he couldn't bring himself to eat food unless it was prepared by his wife. And then one day, his wife got sick and had to go into the hospital, so Gödel stopped eating. I told Davis how, even though Gödel must have known that starvation was a greater risk than poisoning, he just couldn't eat, and so he starved to death. At 71. He cohabitated with the demon for 71 years, and then it got him in the end. When I'd finished the story, he asked,
"Do you worry that will happen to you?"
And I said, "It's so weird to know you're crazy and not be able to do anything about it, you know? It's not like you believe yourself to be normal. You know there is a problem, but you can't figure a way through to fixing it. Because you can't be sure, you know? If you're Gödel, you just can't be sure your food isn't poisoned."
"Do you worry that will happen to you?"
he asked again. "I worry about a lot of things." We kept on talking, for so long that the stars moved above us, until eventually he asked,
"Wanna swim?"
"Bit cold," I said.
"Pool's heated,"
he answered. He stood up and pulled off his shirt, then kicked out of his jeans while I watched. I liked watching him take off his jeans. He was skinny, but I liked his body, the small but sinewy muscles in his back, his goose-bumped legs. Shivering, he jumped into the water.
"Magnificent,"
he said. "I don't have a bathing suit."
"Well, if you have a bra and underwear, that's basically a bikini."
I laughed and took off my coat, then stood up. "Do you mind turning around?" I asked him. He turned toward the dimly lit terrarium where the billionaire in waiting was hiding somewhere in her artificial forest. I wriggled out of my jeans and pulled off my shirt. I felt naked, even though technically I wasn't, but I dropped my hands to my sides and said, "Okay, you can look." I slid into the warmth of the pool next to him. He put his hands on my waist under the water, but didn't try to kiss me. The terrarium was behind him, and now that my eyes were fully adjusted to the dark, I could see the Tuatara on a branch, staring at us through one of her red-black eyes. "Tua's watching us," I said.
"She's such a perv,"
Davis answered, and then turned to look at the animal. Her green skin had some kind of yellow moss growing on it, and I could see her teeth as she breathed with her mouth slightly open. Her miniature crocodile tail flickered suddenly, and Davis startled, curling into me, then laughed.
"I hate that thing,"
he said. It was freezing when we got out. We didn't have any towels, so we carried our clothes in our arms and ran back to the house. Noah was still on the couch playing the same game. I hustled past him and jogged up the marble stairs. Once we were dressed, we went to Davis's bedroom. He put the Iron Man on his bedside table, then knelt down to show me how his telescope worked. He plugged some coordinates into a remote control, and the telescope moved itself. When it stopped, Davis stooped to look through the lens, then cleared the way for me.
That's Tau Ceti,
he said. The way the telescope was zoomed in, I couldn't see anything but darkness and one jittering disk of white light.
12 light-years away. Similar to our sun, but a little smaller. Two of its planets actually might be habitable. Probably not, but maybe. It's my favorite star.
I didn't know what I was supposed to be seeing. It was just a circle like any other. But then he explained.
I like to look at it and think about how the sun's light looks to someone in Tau Ceti's solar system. Right now, they're seeing our light from 12 years ago. In the light they're seeing, my mom has 3 years to live. This house has just been built, and Mom and Dad are always fighting about the layout of the kitchen. In the light they see, you and I are just kids. We've got the best and the worst of it in front of us.
We still have the best and the worst of it in front of us, I said.
I hope not, he said. I sure as hell hope the worst is behind me.
I pulled away from Tau Ceti's 12-year-old light and looked up at Davis. I took his hand, and part of me wanted to tell him I loved him, but I wasn't sure if I really did. Our hearts were broken in the same places. That's something like love, but maybe not quite the thing itself. It sucked having a dead person in your family, and I knew what he meant about seeking solace in the old light. 3 years from now, I knew, he'd find a different favorite star, one with older light to gaze upon. And when time caught up with that one, he'd love a farther star, and a farther one. Because you can't let the light catch up with the present. Otherwise you'd forget. That's why I liked looking at my dad's pictures. It was the same thing, really. Photographs are just light and time. I should go, I said quietly.
Can I see you this weekend?
Yeah, I said.
Could we hang out at your house next time, maybe?
Sure, I said, if you don't mind being harassed by my mother. He assured me he didn't, and then we hugged goodbye, and as I left him alone in his room, he knelt back down to the telescope. When I got home that night, I told Mom that Davis wanted to come over this weekend.
Is he your boyfriend?
She asked. I guess so, I said.
He respects you as an equal?
Yeah.
He listens to you as much as you listen to him?
Well, I'm not great at talking, but yes, he listens to me. He's really, really sweet. And also, at some point, you just have to trust me, you know? She sighed.
All I want in this world is to keep you. Keep you from hurt. Keep you from stress. All that.
I hugged her.
You know I love you.
I smiled. Yeah, Mom, I know you love me. You definitely don't have to worry about that. After going to bed that night, I checked in on Davis's blog. Doubt thou that the stars are fire. Doubt that the sun doth move. William Shakespeare.
It doesn't move, of course. Well, it does, but not around us. Even Shakespeare assumed fundamental truths about the fundament that turned out to be wrong. Who knows what lies I believe, or you do? Who knows what we shouldn't doubt? Tonight, under the sky, she asked me, why do all the ones about me have quotes from The Tempest? Is it because we are shipwrecked? Yes. Yes, it is because we are shipwrecked.
I hit refresh after reading it, just in case, and there was a new entry, posted minutes before. There's an expression in classical music. It goes, "We went out to the meadow." It's for those evenings that can only be described in that way. There were no walls, there were no music stands, there weren't even any instruments. There was no ceiling, there was no floor. We all went out to the meadow.
It describes a feeling. Tom waits.
I know she's reading this right now.
Hi.
I felt like we went out to the meadow tonight, only we weren't playing music. In the best conversations, you don't even remember what you talked about, only how it felt. It was like we weren't even there, lying together by the pool. It felt like we were in some place your body can't visit. Some place with no ceiling and no walls and no floor and no instruments.
And that really should have ended my evening. But instead of going to sleep, I decided to torture myself by reading more Ayala stories. I didn't understand how Davis could like her. She was horrible, totally self-centered and perpetually annoying. At one party scene, Ray observed, "Of course, when Ayala's around, it's never really a party, because at parties, people have fun." Eventually, I clicked away from the site, but I couldn't bring myself to put away the computer and go to sleep. Instead, I ended up on Wikipedia, reading about fan fiction and Star Wars, and then I found myself reading the same old articles about the human microbiota and studies of how people's microbial makeup had shaped and, in some cases, killed them. At one point, I came across this sentence. Mammal brains receive a constant stream of interoceptive input from the GI tract, which combines with other interoceptive information from within the body and contextual information from the environment before sending an integrated response to target cells within the GI tract through what is commonly called the gut-brain informational axis, but might better be described as the gut-brain informational cycle. I realize that's not the sort of sentence that fills most people with horror, but it stopped me cold. It was saying that my bacteria were affecting my thinking. Maybe not directly, but through the information they told my gut to send to my brain. Maybe you're not even thinking this thought. Maybe your thinking's infected. Shouldn't have been reading these articles. Should have gone to sleep. Too late now. I checked the light under the door to make sure Mom had gone to sleep and then snuck over to the bathroom. I changed the Band-Aid, looking carefully at the old one. There was blood. Not a lot, but blood. Faintly pink. It isn't infected. It bleeds because it hasn't scabbed over. But it could be.
It isn't.
Are you sure? Did you even clean it this morning?
Probably. I always clean it.
Are you sure?
Oh, for fuck's sake! I washed my hands, put on a new Band-Aid, but now I was being pulled all the way down. I opened the medicine cabinet quietly, took out the aloe-scented hand sanitizer. I took a gulp, then another. Felt dizzy. You can't do this. This shit's pure alcohol. It'll make you sick.
Better do it again.
Poured some more of it on my tongue. That's enough. You'll be clean after this.
Just get one last swallow down.
I did. Heard my gut rumbling. Stomach hurt.
Sometimes you clear out the healthy bacteria and that's when C. diff comes in. You gotta watch out for that.
Great. You tell me to drink it, then tell me not to.
Back in my room, sweating over the covers, body clammy, corpse-like. Can't get my head straight.
Drinking hand sanitizer is not going to make you healthier, you crazy fuck.
But they can talk to your brain.
They can tell your brain what to think, and you can't. So who's running the show?
Stop it, please.
I tried not to think the thought. But like a dog on a leash, I could only get so far from it before I felt the strangling pull against my throat. My stomach rumbled. Nothing worked. Even giving in to the thought had only provided a moment's release. I returned to a question Dr. Singh had first asked me years ago, the first time it got this bad.
Do you feel like you're a threat to yourself?
But which is the threat, and which is the self? I wasn't not a threat, but couldn't say to whom or what. The pronouns and objects of the sentence muddied by the abstraction of it all. The words sucked into the non-lingual way down. You're a we.
You're a you. You're a she, an it, a they.
My kingdom for an I. Felt myself slipping. But even that's a metaphor. Descending, but that is too. Can't describe the feeling itself except to say that I'm not me. Forged in the smithy of someone else's soul. Please just let me out. Whoever is authoring me, let me up out of this. Anything to be out of this. But I couldn't get out. 3 flakes, then 4 arrive. Then many more. 18. Mom woke me up at 6:50.
Sleep through your alarm? She asked.
I squinted. It was still dark in my room.
I'm fine, I said.
You sure?
Yeah,
I said, and pulled myself out of bed. I was at school just 32 minutes later. I didn't look my best, but I'd long ago given up trying to impress the student body of White River High School. Daisy was sitting alone on the front steps.
You look sleepy,
she said as I walked up. It was cloudy, the kind of day where the sun is a supposition.
Long night. How are you?
Great, except I haven't seen nearly enough of my best friend lately.
You want to hang out later, Applebee's?
Sure, I said.
Also, my mom had to borrow my car, so can we just go together?
I made it through lunch, through the standard post-lunch encounter with Mom worrying over my tired eyes, through history and statistics. In each room, the soul-sucking fluorescent light coated everything in a film of sickness, and the day droned on until the final bell released me at last. I made it to Harold, sat down in the driver's seat, and waited for Daisy. I hadn't been sleeping much. Hadn't been thinking straight. That sanitizer is basically pure alcohol. You can't keep drinking that. Should probably call Dr. Singh, but then you'll have to talk to her answering service and tell a stranger that you're crazy. Can't bear the thought of Dr. Singh calling back, voice tinged with sympathy, asking whether I'm taking the medication every day. Doesn't work anyway. Nothing does. 3 different medications and 5 years of cognitive behavioral therapy later, and here we are. I startled awake at the sound of Daisy opening the passenger door.
You okay?
She asked.
Yeah,
I said. I turned the car on, felt my spine straightening. I reversed out of the parking spot and then waited in line to leave campus.
You barely even changed my name,
I said. My voice felt squeaky, but I was finding it.
Huh?
Ayala? Aza? Beginning of the alphabet to the end and back gave her compulsions. Gave her my personality. Anyone reading it would know how you really feel about me. Michael, Davis, everyone at school, probably.
Aza, Daisy said.
My real name sounded wrong in her voice.
You're not... Oh, fuck off. I've been writing them since I was 11, and you've never read a single one.
You never asked.
First, I did ask. A bunch of times, and then I got tired of you saying you'd read them and never doing it, and second, I shouldn't have to ask. You could take 3 seconds away from your nonstop fucking contemplation of yourself to think about other people's interests. Look, I came up with Ayala in like 7th grade, and it was a dick move, but she's her own character now. She's not you, okay?
We were still inching our way through the student parking lot.
I mean, I love you. And it's not your fault, but your anxiety does kind of invite disasters.
At last, I pulled off campus and headed north up Meridian toward the highway. She kept talking, of course. She always did.
I'm sorry, okay? I should have let Ayala die years ago, but yeah, you're right. It is kind of a way of coping with... I mean, Holmesy, you're exhausting.
Yeah. All our friendship has gotten you in the last couple months is $50,000 and a boyfriend. You're right, I'm a terrible person.
What did you call me in that story?
Useless.
I'm useless.
Aza, she's not you. But you are extremely self-centered. Like, I know you have the mental problems and whatever, but they do make you, you know.
I don't know, actually. They make me what? Michael said once that you're like mustard. Great in small quantities, but then a lot of you is a lot.
I didn't say anything.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that.
We were stopped at a red light, and when it turned green, I was somewhat ungentle with Harold's accelerator. I could feel the heat in my cheeks, but couldn't tell if I was about to start crying or screaming. Daisy kept going.
But you know what I mean. Like, what are my parents' names?
I didn't answer. I didn't know the answer. I just took a long breath, trying to push my heartbeat down into my chest. I didn't need Daisy to point out what a shit show I was. I knew.
What are their jobs? When was the last time you were at my apartment? 5 years ago? We're supposed to be best friends, Holmesy, and you don't even know if I have any fucking pets. You have no idea what it's like for me, and you're so, like, pathologically uncurious that you don't even know what you don't know.
You have a cat, I whispered.
You just have no fucking clue. It's all so fucking easy for you. I mean, you think you and your mom are poor or whatever, but you got braces. You got a car and a laptop and all that shit, and you think it's natural. You think it's just normal to have a house with your own room and a mom who helps you with your homework. You don't think you're privileged, but you have everything. You don't know what it's like for me, and you don't ask. I share a room with my annoying 8-year-old sister whose name you don't know, and then you judge me for buying a car instead of saving it all for college, but you don't know. You want me to be some selfless, proper heroine who's too good for money, but that's bullshit, Holmesy. Being poor doesn't purify you or whatever the fuck. It just sucks. You don't know my life. You haven't taken the time to find out, and you don't get to judge me.
Her name is Elena,
I said quietly.
You think it's hard for you, and I'm sure it is from inside your head, but you can't get it because your privileges are just oxygen to you. I thought the money, I thought it would make us the same. I've always been trying to keep up with you, trying to type as fast on my phone as you can on your laptop, and I thought it would make us closer, but it just made me feel like you're spoiled, kinda. Like, you've had this all along, and you can't even know how much easier it makes everything, because you don't ever think about anybody else's life.
I felt like I might throw up. We merged onto the highway. My head was careening. I hated myself, hated her, thought she was right and wrong, thought I deserved it and didn't.
You think it's easy for me?
I don't mean, I turned to her, stop talking. Jesus Christ, you haven't shut up in 10 years. I'm sorry it's not fun hanging out with me because I'm stuck in my head so much. But imagine being actually stuck inside my head with no way out, with no way to ever take a break from it, because that's my life. To use Michael's clever little analogy, imagine eating nothing but mustard, being stuck with mustard all the time. And if you hate me so much, then stop asking me to. Holmesy! She shouted, but too late.
I looked up only in time to see that I'd kept accelerating while the traffic had slowed. I couldn't even get my foot to the brake before we slammed into the SUV in front of us. A moment later, something slammed into us from behind, tires screeching, honking. Another crash, this one smaller. Then silence. I was trying to catch my breath, but I couldn't, because every breath hurt. I swore, but it just came out as, I reached for the door only to realize my seatbelt was still on. I looked over at Daisy, who was looking back at me.
Are you okay?
She shouted. I realized I was groaning with each exhalation. My ears were ringing.
Yeah,
I said.
You?
The pain made me feel dizzy. Darkness encroached at the edge of my vision.
I think so,
she said. The world narrowed into a tunnel as I struggled for breath.
Stay in the car, Holmesy. You're hurt. Do you have your phone? We gotta call 911.
The phone. I unbuckled my seatbelt and pushed my door open. I tried to stand, but the pain brought me back into Harold's seat. Fuck. Harold. A woman wearing a business suit knelt down to my eye level. She told me not to move, but I had to. I lifted myself up, and the pain blinded me for a minute, but then the black dots scattered so I could see the damage. Harold's trunk was as crumpled as his hood. He looked like a seismograph reading, except for the passenger compartment, which was perfectly intact. He never failed me, not even when I failed him. I leaned on Harold's side as I staggered back to the trunk. I tried to lift the trunk gate, but it was crushed. I started pounding on the trunk with my hands, screaming with every breath.
Fuck! Oh, God! Oh, God! Oh, God! He's totaled! He's totaled!
You're kidding me, Daisy said as she walked to the back of Harold.
You're upset about the goddamn car? It's a car, Holmesy. We almost died, and you're worried about your car?
I pounded on the trunk again until Harold's license plate slid off, but I couldn't get it open.
Are you crying about the car?
I could see the latch. I just couldn't get it pried open. And whenever I tried to lift, the pain in my ribs made my vision cloud up, but I finally wrested the trunk open enough to reach my arm inside. I fumbled around until I found my dad's phone. The screen was shattered. I held the power button to turn it on, but beneath the branches of broken glass, the screen only glowed a cloudy gray. I pulled myself back to the driver's side door and slumped into Harold's seat, my forehead on the steering wheel. I knew the pictures were backed up, that nothing had really been lost, but it was his phone, you know? He'd held it, talked into it, taken my picture with it. I ran my thumb across the shattered glass and cried until I felt a hand on my shoulder.
My name's Franklin. You've been in a car accident. I'm a firefighter. Try not to move. An ambulance is on its way. What's your name?
Aza. I'm not hurt.
Just hang tight for me, Aza. Do you know what day it is?
It's my dad's phone, I said. This is his phone, and...
Is this his car? Are you worried he'll be upset? Aza, I've been doing this for a long time, and I can promise your dad's not mad at you. He's relieved you're okay.
I felt like I was getting ripped apart from the inside, the supernova of myself simultaneously exploding and collapsing. It hurt to cry, but I hadn't cried in so long, and I didn't really want to stop.
Where are you having pain? He asked.
I pointed toward the right side of my rib cage. A woman approached, and they began a conversation about whether I'd need a backboard. I tried to say that I felt dizzy and then felt myself falling, even though there was really nowhere to fall. I woke up staring at the ceiling of an ambulance, strapped to a backboard, a man holding an oxygen mask over my face, the sirens distant, my ears still ringing. Then falling again, down and down. And then on a hospital bed in a hallway, Mom over me, makeup dripping from her red eyes.
My baby. Oh, Lord. Baby, are you all right?
I'm fine, I said. I think I just cracked a rib or something.
Dad's phone is broken. It's okay. We have everything backed up. They called me and told me you were hurt, but they didn't tell me if you were...
She said, and then started crying. She sort of collapsed into Daisy, which is when I noticed Daisy was there, a red welt on her collarbone. I turned away from them and looked up at the bright fluorescent light above my bed, feeling the hot tears on my face, and finally my mom said,
I can't lose you too.
A woman came in and took me away to get a CT scan, and I was sort of relieved to be away from both my mom and Daisy for a while, not to feel the swirl of fear and guilt over being such a failure as a daughter and a friend.
Car accident? The woman asked as she pushed me past the word kindness painted in calligraphy on the wall.
Yeah,
I said.
Those seatbelts will hurt you while saving your life, she said.
Yeah, am I gonna need antibiotics?
I'm not your doctor. She'll be in after we get the test.
They put something in my IV that made me feel like I was pissing my pants, then ran me through the cylinder of the CT machine and eventually returned me to the shivering nerves of my mother. I couldn't shake the crack in her voice when she said she couldn't lose me, too. I felt her nerves as she paced around the room, texting with my aunt and uncle in Texas, pressing long breaths through pursed lips, dabbing at her eye makeup with a tissue. Daisy didn't say much for once.
It's okay if you want to go home,
I said to her at one point.
Do you want me to go home? She asked.
Up to you,
I said.
Seriously. I'll stay,
she answered, and sat quietly, her eyes glancing from me to my mom and back again.
XIX.
Good news and bad news, announced a woman in navy blue scrubs upon entering the room. Bad news, you have a lacerated liver. Good news, it's a mild laceration. We'll watch you closely for a couple days so we can make sure your bleeding doesn't increase, and you'll be sore for several weeks, but I'm ordering you pain medication now so you'll be comfortable. Questions?
She's going to be okay?
My mom asked. Yes. If the bleeding worsens, surgery will be necessary, but based on the radiologist's report, I think that's very unlikely. As liver lacerations go, this is about as good as they get. Your daughter is really quite lucky in the scheme of things.
She's going to be okay, my mom said again.
As I said, we'll keep a close eye on her for a couple days, and then she'll have about a week of bed rest. Within 6 or so weeks, she should be her old self.
My mother dissolved into tears of gratitude as I turned over that phrase, her old self.
Do I need antibiotics? I asked.
You shouldn't. If we had to do surgery, you would, but as of now, no.
A shiver of relief rolled through me. No antibiotics. No increased risk of C. diff. Just needed to get the hell out of here then.
The doctor asked me about my medications, and I told her. She made some notes in the chart and then said, Someone will be by shortly to take you upstairs, and we'll get you something for the pain before that.
Wait,
I said.
What do you mean upstairs?
As I said, you'll need to spend a couple nights here so that you can...
Wait, no, I can't stay in the hospital.
Baby, my mom said.
You have to. No, I really can't. This is, like, the one place I absolutely cannot stay tonight. Please, just let us go home.
That would be inadvisable.
Oh, no.
Listen, it's okay. Most people admitted to the hospital go home healthier than they left it. Almost everyone, really. C. diff infections are only common in post-surgical patients. You won't even be on antibiotics. Oh, no.
Of all the places to end up in the tightening gyre, here we were, on the 4th floor of a hospital in Carmel, Indiana. Daisy left once I'd gotten upstairs, but Mom stayed, lying on her side in the reclining chair next to my hospital bed, facing me. I could feel her breath on me that night as she slept, her lips parted, smudged eyes closed. The microbes from her lungs floating across my cheek. I couldn't roll over onto my side, because even with the medication, the pain was paralyzing. And when I turned my head, her breath just blew my hair across my face. So I lived with it. She stirred, her eyes locked to mine.
You okay?
Yeah, I said.
Does it hurt?
I nodded.
You know, Sekou Sundiata, in a poem, he said the most important part of the body ain't the heart or the lungs or the brain. The biggest, most important part of the body is the part that hurts.
Mom put her hand on my wrist and fell back asleep. Even though I was pretty high on morphine or whatever, I couldn't sleep. I could hear beeping in the rooms next to mine, and it wasn't particularly dark, and well-meaning strangers kept showing up to pull blood out of my body and or check my blood pressure, and most of all, I knew. I knew that C. diff was invading my body, that it was floating in the air. On my phone, I paged through patients' stories of how they went into the hospital for a gallbladder surgery or a kidney stone, and they'd come out destroyed. The thing about C. diff is that it's inside of everyone. We all have it, lurking there. It's just that sometimes it grows out of control and takes over and begins attacking your insides. Sometimes it just happens. Sometimes it happens because you ingest someone else's C. diff, which is slightly different from your own, and it starts mixing with yours, and boom. I felt these little jolts through my arms and legs as my brain whirred through thoughts, trying to figure out how to make this okay. My IV line beeping. Couldn't even say when I last changed the band-aid on my finger. The C. diff both inside me and around me. It could survive months outside a body, waiting for a new host. The combined weight of all large animals in the world, human, cow, penguin, shark, is around 1.1 billion tons. The combined weight of the Earth's bacteria is 400 billion tons. They overwhelm us. For some reason, I started hearing that song, Can't Stop Thinking About You, in my head. The more I thought about that song, the weirder it got. Like the chorus, Can't stop, can't stop, can't stop thinking about you. Imagines that it is somehow sweet or romantic to be unable to turn your thoughts away from someone, but there's nothing romantic or pretty about a boy thinking about you the way you think about C. diff. Can't stop thinking. Trying to find something solid to hold on to in this rolling sea of thought. The spiral painting. Daisy hates you, and she should. Davis's microbe-soaked tongue on your neck, your mom's warm breaths, hospital gown clinging to your back soaked with sweat, and in the way down deep, some me screaming, get me out of here, get me out of here, get me out, please, I'll do anything. But the thoughts just keep spinning. The tightening gyre, the jogger's mouth, the stupidity of Ayala, Aza, and Holmesy, and all my irreconcilable selves, my self-absorption, the filth in my gut. Think about anything other than yourself, you disgusting narcissist. I took my phone and texted Daisy. I'm so sorry I haven't been a good friend. I can't stop thinking about it. She wrote back immediately. It's fine. How are you? Me.
I do care about your life, and I'm sorry I haven't shown it.
Daisy.
Holmesy, calm down. Everything is fine. I'm sorry we fought. We'll make up. It will be fine.
Me.
I'm just really sorry. I can't think straight.
Daisy.
Stop apologizing. Are you on sweet pain meds? I didn't reply, but I couldn't stop thinking about Daisy, about Ayala, and most of all about the bugs inside and outside of me, and I knew I was being selfish by even making a big deal out of it, making other people's real C. diff infections about my hypothetical one. Reprehensible. Pinched my finger with my thumbnail to attest to this moment's reality, but can't escape myself. Can't kiss anyone, can't drive a car, can't function in the actual sensate-populated world. How could I even fantasize about going to some school far away where you pay a fortune to live in dorms full of strangers, with communal bathrooms and cafeterias, and no private spaces to be crazy in?
I'd be stuck here for college if I could ever get my thinking straightened enough to attend. I'd live in my house with Mom, and then afterward, too. I could never become a functioning grown-up like this. It was inconceivable that I'd ever have a career. In job interviews, they'd ask me, "What's your greatest weakness?" And I'd explain that I'll probably spend a good portion of the workday terrorized by thoughts I'm forced to think, possessed by a nameless and formless demon, so if that's going to be an issue, you might not want to hire me. Thoughts are just a different kind of bacteria colonizing you. I thought about the gut-brain information axis. Maybe you're already gone. The prisoners run the jail now. Not a person, so much as a swarm. Not a bee, but the hive. I couldn't stand my mother's breath on my face. My palms were sweating. I felt myself slipping away. You know how to deal with this.
"Can you turn over?"
I whispered. But she responded only with breath. "You just need to stand up." I picked up my phone to text Daisy, but now the letters blurred out on the screen, and the full panic gripped me. See the hand sanitizer mounted on the wall near the door? It's the only way. That's stupid. If it worked, alcoholics would be the healthiest people in the world. You're just going to sanitize your hands and your mouth. Please fucking think about something else. Stand up. I hate being stuck inside you. You are me. I am not. You are we. I am not. You want to feel better. You know how to feel better. It'll just make me barf. You'll be clean, you can be sure. I can never be sure. Stand up. Not even a person, just a deeply flawed line of reasoning. You want to stand up. The doctor said stay in bed and the last thing needed is a surgery. You will get up and wheel your IV cart. Let me up out of this. Wheel your IV cart to the front of the room. Please. And you will pump the hand sanitizer foam into your hands, clean them carefully, and then you will pump more foam into your hands, and you will put that foam in your mouth, swish it around your filthy teeth and gums. But that stuff has alcohol in it that my damaged liver will have to process. Do you want to die of C. diff? No, but this is not rational. Then get up and wheel your IV cart to the container of hand sanitizer mounted on the goddamned wall, you idiot. Please let me go. I'll do anything. I'll stand down. You can have this body. I don't want it anymore. You will stand up. I will not. I am my way, not my will. You will stand up. Please. You will go to the hand sanitizer. Cogito, ergo non sum. Sweating, you already have it. Nothing hurts like this. You've already got it. Stop, please, God, stop. You'll never be free of this. You'll never be free of this. You'll never get yourself back. You'll never get yourself back. Do you want to die of this? Do you want to die of this? Because you will. You will. You will. You will. You will. You will. I pulled myself to standing. For a moment, I thought I might faint as the pain blazed through me. I grabbed hold of the IV pole and took a few shuffling steps. I heard my mom stirring. I didn't care. Pressed the dispenser, rubbed the foam all through my hands, pressed it again, and shoved a scoop of it into my mouth.
"Aza? What are you doing?"
my mom asked. I was so fucking embarrassed, but I did it again because I had to.
"Aza, stop it!"
I heard my mom getting up and knew my window was closing, so I took a third shot of the foam and stuffed it into my mouth, gagging. A spasm of nausea lurched through me, and I vomited, the pain in my ribs blinding as Mom grabbed me by the arm. There was yellow bile all over my pale blue hospital gown. A voice came from inside a speaker somewhere behind me.
"This is Nurse Wallace. My daughter is vomiting. I think she drank hand sanitizer."
I knew how disgusting I was. I knew. I knew now for sure. I wasn't possessed by a demon. I was the demon. 20. The next morning, you wake up in a hospital bed, staring up at ceiling tiles. Gingerly, carefully, you assess your own consciousness for a moment. You wonder, is it over?
The hospital food didn't look so good, so I made you some breakfast, your mother says. Cheerios.
You look down at your body, rendered mostly formless by a bleached white blanket. You say,
Cheerios aren't something you make,
and your mom laughs. At the end of your bed, you see a huge bouquet of flowers resting on a table, ostentatiously huge, complete with a crystal vase.
From Davis, your mother says.
Nearer to you, hovering above your formless body, a tray of food. You swallow. You look at the Cheerios, bobbing in milk. Your body hurts. A thought crosses your mind. God only knows what you inhaled while you were asleep. It's not over. You lie there, not even thinking, really, except to try to consider how to describe the hurt, as if finding the language for it might bring it up out of you. If you can make something real, if you can see it and smell it and touch it, then you can kill it. You think, it's like a brain fire, like a rodent gnawing at you from the inside, a knife in your gut, a spiral, whirlpool, black hole. The words used to describe it, despair, fear, anxiety, obsession, do so little to communicate it. Maybe we invented metaphor as response to pain. Maybe we needed to give shape to the opaque, deep-down pain that evades both sense and senses. For a moment, you think you're better. You've just had a successful train of thought, with an engine and a caboose and everything. Your thoughts, authored by you. And then you feel a wave of nausea, a fist clenching from within your ribcage, cold sweat, hot forehead. You've got it. It's already inside of you, crowding out everything else, taking you over, and it's going to kill you and eat its way out of you. And then in a small voice, half strangled by the ineffable horror, you barely squeeze out the words you need to say.
I'm in trouble, Mom. Big trouble.
21. The arc of the story goes like this. Having descended into proper madness, I begin to make the connections that crack open the long dormant case of Russell Pickett's disappearance. My dogged obsessiveness leads me to ignore all manner of threats and the risk to the fortune Daisy and I have stumbled into. I focus only on the mystery and embrace the belief that solving it is the ultimate good, that declarative sentences are inherently better than interrogative ones, and in finding the answer despite my madness, I simultaneously find a way to live with the madness. I become a great detective, not in spite of my brain circuitry, but because of it. I'm not sure who I walk into the sunset with in the proper story, Davis or Daisy, but I walk into it. You see me backlit, an eclipse silhouetted by the 8-minute-old light of our home star, holding hands with somebody. And along the way, I realize that I have agency over myself, that my thoughts are, as Dr. Singh likes to say, only thoughts. I realize that my life is a story that I'm telling, and I'm free and empowered and the captain of my consciousness, and yeah, no, that's not how it went down. I did not become dogged or declarative. Nor did I walk off into the sunset. In fact, for a while there, I saw hardly any natural light at all. What happened was relentlessly and excruciatingly dull. I lay in a hospital bed and hurt. My ribs hurt. My brain hurt. My thoughts hurt. And they did not let me go home for 8 days. At first, they figured me for an alcoholic, that I'd gone for the hand sanitizer because I was so desperate for a drink. The truth was so much weirder and less rational that nobody really seemed to buy it until they contacted Dr. Singh. When she arrived at the hospital, She pulled a chair up to the edge of my bed.
Two things happened,
she said.
First, you're not taking your medication as prescribed.
I told her I'd taken it almost every day, which felt true, but wasn't.
I felt like it was making me worse, I eventually confessed.
Aza, you're an intelligent young woman. Surely you don't think drinking hand sanitizer while hospitalized for a lacerated liver marks forward progress in your mental health journey.
I just stared at her.
As I'm sure they explained to you, drinking hand sanitizer is dangerous, not only because of the alcohol, but because it contains chemicals that, when ingested, can kill you. So we're not moving forward with the idea that the medicine you stopped taking was making you worse.
She said it all so forcefully that I just nodded.
And the second thing that happened is that you experienced in the accident a serious trauma. And this would be challenging for anyone.
I kept staring.
We need to get you on a different medication, one that works better for you, that you can tolerate, and that you'll take.
None of them work.
None of them have worked yet, she corrected.
Dr. Singh came by each morning. And then in the afternoon, another doctor visited to assess my liver situation. Both were a relief, if for no other reason than my omnipresent mother was forced to leave the room briefly. On the last day, Dr. Singh sat down next to the side of my bed and placed a hand on my shoulder. She'd never touched me before.
I recognize that a hospital setting has probably not been great for your anxiety.
Yeah.
I said,
do you feel you are a threat to yourself?
No, I said. I'm just really scared and having a lot of invasives.
Did you consume hand sanitizer yesterday?
No.
I'm not here to judge you, Aza, but I can only help if you're being honest.
I am being honest. I haven't.
For one thing. They'd taken the wall-mounted sanitizer station out of my room.
Have you thought about it?
Yeah.
You don't have to be afraid of that thought. Thought is not action.
I can't stop thinking about getting C. diff. I just want to be sure that I'm not
drinking hand sanitizer won't help.
But what will help?
Time. Treatment. Taking your meds.
I feel like a noose is tightening around me, and I want out, but struggling only cinches the knot. The spiral just keeps tightening, you know?
She looked me dead in the eye. I thought she might cry or something, the way she was looking at me.
Aza, you're going to survive this.
Even after they let me go home, Dr. Singh still came to my house twice a week to check on my progress. I had switched to a different medication, which Mom made sure I took every morning, and I wasn't allowed to get up except to go to the bathroom, lest I re-lacerate my liver. I was out of school for 2 weeks. 14 days of my life reduced to one sentence, because I can't describe anything that happened during those days. It hurt all the time. In a way language could not touch. It was boring. It was predictable. Like walking a maze you know has no solution. It's easy enough to say what it was like, but impossible to say what it was. Daisy and Davis both tried to visit, but I wanted to be alone, in bed. I didn't read or watch TV, neither could adequately distract me. I just lay there. Almost catatonic, as my mother hovered perpetually near, breaking the silence every few minutes with a question phrased as a statement.
Each day is a little better. You're feeling okay. You're improving.
The inquisition of declarations.
I didn't even turn on my phone for a while, a decision endorsed by Dr. Singh. When I finally did power it up, I felt an insoluble fear. I both wanted to find a lot of text messages and didn't. Turns out I had over 30 messages, not just from Daisy and Davis, although they had written, but also from Michael and other friends, and even some teachers. I returned to school on a Monday morning in early December. I wasn't sure if the new medication was working, but I also wasn't wondering whether to take it. I felt ready, like I had returned to the world, not my old self, but myself nonetheless. Mom drove me to school. Harold had been totaled, and anyway, I was too scared of driving.
"Excited or nervous?"
Mom asked me. She drove with both hands on the steering wheel. 10 and 2 o'clock.
"Nervous,"
I said.
"Your teachers, your friends, they all understand, Aza. They just want you well and will support you 100%, and if they don't, I will crush them."
I smiled a little. "Everyone knows, is all, that I went crazy or whatever."
"Oh, sweetie,"
she said.
"You didn't go crazy. You've always been crazy."
Now I laughed, and she reached over to squeeze my wrist. Daisy was waiting on the front steps. Mom stopped the car, and I got out, the weight of the backpack still tender against my ribs. It was a cold day, but the sun was bright even though it had just risen, and I kept blinking away the light. It had been a while since I'd spent much time outside. Daisy looked different, her face brighter somehow. It took me a second to realize she'd gotten a haircut, a just-under-the-chin bob that looked really good.
"Can I hug you without lacerating your liver?"
"I like the new hairstyle," I said as we hugged.
"You're sweet, but we both know it's a disaster."
"Listen," I said.
"I'm really sorry."
"Me too, but we have forgiven each other, and now we will live happily ever after."
"Seriously, though," I said. "I feel terrible about..."
"I do too,"
she said.
"You gotta read my new story, man. It's a 15,000-word apology set on post-apocalyptic Jeddah. What I want to say to you, Holmesy, is that yes, you are exhausting, and yes, being your friend is work. But you are also the most fascinating person I have ever known. And you are not like mustard, you are like pizza, which is the highest compliment I can pay a person."
"I'm just really sorry, Daisy, for not being..."
"Jesus Christ, Holmesy, you can sure hold a grudge against yourself. You are my favorite person. I want to be buried next to you. We'll have a shared tombstone. It'll read, 'Holmesy and Daisy, they did everything together except the nasty.' Anyway, how are you?"
I shrugged.
"Want me to keep talking?"
I nodded.
"You know how sometimes people will say, like, 'Oh, she really loves the sound of her voice'? I do seriously love the sound of my voice. I've got a voice for radio."
She turned and started walking up the stairs to get in line for the metal detectors.
"So I know what you're wondering. Daisy, are you still dating Michael? Where's your car? What happened to your hair? The answers are no, sold, and a cut became necessary after Elena intentionally put 3 pieces of chewed bubblegum in my hair while I was sleeping. It's been a long 2 weeks, Holmesy. Should I elaborate?"
I nodded.
"With pleasure,"
she answered as we cleared the metal detectors.
"So, with Michael, it really boiled down to my need to be young and wild and free, like I had this near-death experience and then thought, do I really want to waste my youth in a capital R relationship? And so I was like, let's see other people. And he was like, no. And I was like, please. And he was like, I want to be in a monogamous relationship. And I was like, I just don't want the weight of this, like, thing dominating my life. And he was like, I'm not a thing. And then we broke up. I think technically he dumped me in the end, but it was one of those things where you'd need, like, a 3-judge panel to determine who was technically at fault. Anyway, then with the car, it turns out that cars are expensive to own, and also it turns out that they can hurt you, so I got a refund because I had it less than 60 days, and now I'm just going to Uber everywhere for the rest of my life, because then it's kind of like I have every car, and also, as a rich person, I deserve to be chauffeured. Should I keep going?"
We'd reached my locker now,
and I was surprised to find that I remembered the combination. There were so many human bodies around me, I kind of couldn't believe it.